So I want to extend a discussion I began on the Zero Books podcast, which is a very simple thing. I just want to talk about the title of my book and really read the book through the title, which is something I always like doing with other books. Right? I love that every moment of any given text is the expression of that way of going. I love the titles. I love the way it feels in my hand, you know, or I don't like the way it feels in my hand, or the unwieldiness, right? The reality of reading Moby Dick is the size of it, right? This is not something that can be ignored or poo-pooed. It's not like the literature is invisible. The literature is embodied. Think about that. The literature that is Moby Dick is this, has a weight. Physical weight, has a font. One problem I have had with that book and with Ulysses, James Joyce, is finding a font and a book that feels right in my hand without a font being too small. You see a cool-looking book, it feels right, but then the font's too small. You ramp up that font. I'm an old man. I need a bigger font. And the book begins to get unwieldy, right? So there's a materiality to things, and a thing expresses itself in everything it does, which is part of reading the way of things, which is the title of my book. So reading, and it's I come back to this word a lot. You know, give me a read. What's your reading of this? Because we generally associate reading with a certain with a decoding of letters, right? That's what we consider literacy and reading. Did you read that? Which we mean, did you follow those words and decipher them into some kind of meaning? I want to suggest that act that we take as an assumption is something that cannot be assumed, is something that is historical, and that there is a genealogy of reading, that there are technologies of reading, which is part of the subtitle of my book. I want to suggest that reading is an act that is configured culturally, historically, personally, existentially, and ontologically. Jesus, it's a lot of words. But what I mean is that reading is not just deciphering the world. Reading is not just assuming that it comes after the fact, that the world expresses itself in a certain, you know, mode, you know, visual or with words, and I guess words are visual when they're written, and then we just read them as if they're just there. Reading is itself an act that constitutes, that is constitutive of that thing. It has to be. The world's not passive. You're not outside the fray of things. The act of reading is in and of itself an historical act. It's a stylized act, meaning it takes on your style. We read things differently. There is no neutral reading. There is no one reading. To read something is to engage it. And so by calling my rather than saying interpretation and saying reading, what I wanted to do was make reading this thing we just did not assume. I want to make every moment of participation in the world, even perception, as already a stylized act, always an ideological act, always an existential act, always a pathetic act in terms of being a feeling, that there's no neutrality. Reading the way of things, because reading is not, again, just decipherment. I wanted to elevate the notion of literacy or shift our notion of literacy so that it's not just decoding, but the ability to decode the code itself and shift the terms of engagement. So I come back to this word reading. Over and over, and it's why my book is called Reading the Way of Things, and why I think it makes a great sort of primer, in a way, for for teaching interpretation, for teaching writing. And this book really came out of my experiences teaching writing. And one thing I learned in teaching writing was that I had to teach people to read. There's no such thing as writing without reading. And I know that's something that's thrown around a lot, but let's say you want to write something about an essay. Let's say it's, you know, an essay by Nietzsche or it's Moby Dick. Well, there's no writing that hasn't already metabolized, already made sense of, already processed that book, that object. Let's say it's Moby Dick, meaning there's no writing that isn't already a reading. You've read that, and now it's coming out the other side, and that's what the writing is. The reading and writing are therefore very intimately intertwined. And I think this is an essential part of the pedagogy of composition. And I remember a million years ago, I applied for a job teaching comp at the Stanford Humanities Writing Program. And I remember doing the phone interview with, I don't even remember the woman's name, who was famous in composition theory and written some book. And I remember she said to me, she goes, "Oh, I'm reading through all your stuff and everything you're saying, but it sounds like you're really teaching critical thinking, critical reading, as opposed to teaching writing." And I was sort of dumbfounded because I don't think the two are distinct. I know that there are classes in which I've only taught critical thinking and not writing. And in those classes, I think I fail in a way, because in order to think critically, you have to write. And I think that my greatest sort of pedagogic successes and really delights at the end came from teaching writing and teaching the intimacy of doing a critical reading of something, and how you read it and then how you write it. Those two things necessarily have to sort of happen together. And I don't think I'm alone in this. I think it was when we were teaching comp in grad school, which is how everyone in sort of my department, rhetoric, we would get paid, you know, because Berkeley doesn't have a lot of money in the humanities. You don't really get paid. So we teach, and we teach composition, a required class. And I think across the board in rhetoric, we all sort of believed that in order to teach writing, you had to teach reading, that the two are just not, you can't separate them. Right, they are inseparable, and I think that is profound. And I think, I think that's overlooked. And I think, there were definitely exercises I would do in my comp classes that focused on just words. You know, I do a lecture on punctuation. It was always one of my favorite lectures. But then every week we would also read out loud. And I found, and the point of that was to try to find rhythm. And everyone would go around the room reading a certain passage from whatever we were reading. And I would purposefully introduce certain texts that were rhythmically complex or interesting. You know, one of my favorites was Allen Ginsberg's Howl. And his rhythm is so incantational, but surprising, and has these sort of backbeats and stutters and fills. So, just reading out loud, which wasn't, I found that an incredibly useful experience. And I would always tell my students to read their own writing out loud, right? Because if it doesn't flow, then something's wrong, right? And that is a part of writing, is an ability to put ideas and affect and feeling into a shape and into an experience that resonates in the bodies, minds, tongues, throats of other people. And so the rhythm of the language, the rhythm of how the letters go together, the words go together, the consonants clash or resonate, the way vowels open up or close, the way punctuation times the whole thing. It's really important. And I'd often talk about paragraphs in terms of pacing, right? I'd say paragraphs frame an idea and pace a paper. you know, in certain, you know, you start reading more avant-garde writing, and there's no paragraph breaks. Just there's a sort of tumbling, but they're going for a certain experience. We all know if you open a book and you see no paragraph breaks, you know that you as a reader will not have a break, right? That something is being asked of you. And that's already a demand. It's visual. You haven't even entered the realm of the ideas. You haven't even entered the realm of the words, the realm of the feelings. You just look and you already know that you're not going to be able to rest. It's like knowing you're going to be running a 5K, a 10K, a marathon. If you see a paragraph break, you know you can pause. I always pictured the indentation of a paragraph as being a place a reader can sit and pause for a minute and dangle their feet within the text, right? It's a moment of pause within the text. And so the way a writer paces his or her paper, his or her writing, right, includes a sort of the paragraphs, the punctuation, the letters, the spacing, the entire rhythm. So when I was teaching comp and teaching writing, you know, we focus a lot on reading the text. But there were exercises that focused on something we could call writing that's not reading in a sense, right? Which is this rhythm. I used to do a free writing exercise in which, you know, I just throw some topic on the board like, you know, is the moon, you know, does the moon go around the earth? It didn't really matter what the question was. And then I time it 5 minutes, and students couldn't pick up their pens for 5 minutes. And there was no question of editing, no question of an argument, no question of structure, no question of punctuation, just write. And what I found was when I would ask students to read back what they'd written during their free writing, generally speaking, really almost exclusively, the writing was gorgeous. It had a great rhythm. It had a great flow. The ideas might not, but the words certainly did. But if I only taught that, then how would they know how to structure an essay? So they start getting in the rhythm of words, but what about the rhythm of ideas? And what about the rhythm of discovery, the rhythm of revelation, the rhythm of having your world configured? You want the writer to be able to move through the text as if you're reading it with them, right? In that sense, writing, at least critical writing, expositional writing, is always writing about something. There's definitely other kinds of writing, but the writing I'm talking about is a reading. And again, it's why I title my book Reading the Way of Things, and why I consider reading such an essential process of writing and of the world, because it is an inaugural act. It is a creative act. I think when we consider reading as a decoding, as really just the deciphering of letters on a page, we turn it into this passive thing, right? And the written word remains this external sanctified object, and then and we as readers are just supposed to decipher it and translate. But when one claims that reading is creative, is inaugural, is generative, then the very posture in which we stand towards the world and its expression fundamentally changes. Rather than the world coming to us and I'm just supposed to understand what's already there, my moment of engagement with the thing becomes freaking creative. Becomes something to reckon. I come to the world comes to me, and together we try to make something freaking gorgeous and smart and relevant and loving or whatever it is. It fundamentally changes our posture. In many ways, it's all I've really been talking about for years, is is shifting or trying to shift the sort of general register and posturing that we take as we, me, you, my son, your sons, your friends, everyone around us approaches the world. Approaching the world not as something to be deciphered, but as something to go with, as something to collaborate with, as something to create with, to be infused with and to infuse yourself into and with. This intertwining that together you go with its momentum and you lean into it and it leans into you, and together you make this shape. You make this other thing, and that other thing is your reading. Is your reading. And maybe it only gets expressed in your life. Maybe it just gets expressed in your life and the things you desire and the things you like. It gets expressed when you're ordering dinner, when you're making dinner, when you're making breakfast, when you're making your coffee. Because you've gone with coffee. You've leaned into coffee and coffee's leaned into you. And you've come out this other way with this mode of coffee that just is right. That serves you. You serve it. And together you make a nice thing. This is true if it's a critical writing you're doing, right? You're reading Nietzsche and you're writing something. It's not, you know, the tendency of students is to think that literacy is deciphering, saying Nietzsche says this, Nietzsche says this. They just want to list the things Nietzsche says. They're not reading it. They're not saying, you know what, Nietzsche? I'm going to lean into you and you're going to take me somewhere crazy, and I'm going to take you somewhere, man. I'm going to take you somewhere. And together, you make this thing, which is this interpretation. There's that word interpretation. But what I mean by that is this spin, this instantiation, this version of Nietzsche. Gilles Deleuze's books on philosophy are great this way, right? His book on Kant, his two books on Spinoza, his book on Leibniz, his book on Foucault, his book on Nietzsche. And he's so great at really getting, you know, crawling into something, crawling into the skin of something. So that when you're reading his take on Leibniz, you know, his great book, The Fold, definitely one of the more profound, influential books in my life, you get this Deleuze Leibniz. You get this going together. It's in fact, I came to Leibniz through Deleuze, and same with Spinoza. And when I got to Bergson, I purposely didn't read Deleuze's book on Bergson because he gets so intimate with the text. It becomes so, it's so thorough that it's hard for me to read it. It took me a long time to be able to read Leibniz free of Deleuze's penetrating, elaborate, chiasmatic marbling with that text that is The Fold. But I began to make my own sense in the monadology over time. Which was really fun too. But Bergson, I wanted to make my own sense and then read Deleuze's book, which, to be honest, I haven't. I've read a lot of it, but I like my reading of Bergson, and I'm not ready for someone else's to take over my world, because I'm still wrestling it. When I know something really well, I love reading different interpretations of it, because then it refreshes it for me, right? It makes it new. I read a different reading of Nietzsche. I'm like, oh, hey, look at that. I never would have thought of Nietzsche that way. Bergson's still so unwieldy to me. I'm getting there. I'm not ready to be occupied by Deleuze's influential readings. Influential for me, I don't mean influential canonically. So that's that's my reading of reading, and why I use that word in the title of my book. What I hope is over the next few sort of podcasts, I will flesh out sort of the implications of each word of the title, because it's fun, and thanks for listening.